Thank you for joining me on part two of this episode, A Changed Mind. And without getting into much of any introduction, let's get right to the subject matter I want to continue discussing from my perspective. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Let's talk about the presidential shooting on Elm Street. The amazing thing about the shooting itself is it was captured in its entirety by Abraham Zapruder, standing on a cement block on top of the knoll. You see everything except for about a second when a roadway sign for Stimmons Freeway obscures the car and occupants inside. The problem with the Zapruder film is if you slow down what you're looking at, you start believing you're seeing something that you don't see in real time. This is exactly what we have with determining what certain things mean. Could a flash in the film be an issue with the physical film itself, or could it be a bullet ricocheting off the street or sidewalk? Does a minor hand or body movement at one frame every 2 seconds or so be completely different if the film was playing at the normal 18.5 frames per second? This is my point. If you go frame by frame by frame, slight movements here and there could be used in an argument to say something significant is happening. But what if you just play it in real time? You don't see those little things, and you get the big picture. At one point, two people are sitting in a car. Then suddenly, they start to move about oddly. I do not believe whatsoever the time frame of the shooting itself was 5.6 seconds. Starting with President Kennedy and Governor Connally's reactions when they reappear from behind the Stimmons Freeway road sign, and ending with the obvious shot to President Kennedy's head. I think the shooting began several seconds beforehand. What we see in real time in the Zapruder film matches exactly with Governor Connally's statements after the assassination. When the film opens up, President Kennedy is looking and waving to his left. Governor Connally is also looking to his left, as is Mrs. Kennedy. As President Kennedy lowers his arm but keeps his hand raised, there is no question in my mind this is when shot number one was fired. Both Kennedy and Connally simultaneously quickly look to their right. Connally flinches. Kennedy stops waving entirely. Governor Connally stated that prior to when he was shot, he heard a noise and he turned to look over his right shoulder, then straightened up and began to look over his left shoulder. This is exactly what we see in the opening section of the Zapruder film when the presidential limousine appears. Fear, however, must not have registered at all in President Kennedy's mind as he raises his hand to wave a final time, then begins lowering his arm again as the car begins to be obscured by the road sign. That is shot number one. No question. It clearly misses the car. It was likely deflected by a tree branch, in my opinion, and flew off toward the direction of James Tague, who was hit by shrapnel after a bullet struck the curb between Main and Commerce Streets. Now comes a very important question. Do I think President John F. Kennedy and Governor John Connally react at the same time to a gunshot the instant they reappear from behind the Stimmons Freeway road sign? Since the answer to this question starts to completely shape what I now believe happened without any doubt, I'm going to ask the question again. Do I think President Kennedy and Governor Connally react at the same time to a gunshot the instant they reappear from behind the Stimmons Freeway road sign? I believe they do. They go behind the sign, seated in the car. Then they reappear. Immediately, JFK rises, making two fists, and raises them to his throat. Connally jerks downward, but then starts to turn around to look behind him. They're reacting at the exact same time. However, I do not believe this is when Governor Connally was shot in the wrist. I believe the single shot entered Kennedy's upper back and traveled down to the bottom of his throat, went in a straight line into Connally's extreme right back under his armpit because of the way he was seated inward in the car, exited his chest, and went directly into his thigh. No damage to the wrist at this point. Because when he turns back, he is holding his hat. There is no way, in my opinion, anyone could hold anything like that with a gunshot wound to the wrist. I do totally understand and completely respect the argument that the bullet the government says went through both men is too pristine to have done even everything I just described, removing one of the wounds from the equation. I get that. I struggle with that too. But given the physical movement of both men simultaneously has led me to believe they were struck by the same bullet. Let's now get to the other big question. Do I believe you can be hit in the back of the head and react the way Kennedy's body involuntarily does by snapping backward as he falls to his left? Again, considering the implications of my decision will weigh heavily on my opinion of Oswald's guilt or innocence, I will ask this question a second time. Do I believe you can be hit in the back of the head and react the way Kennedy's body involuntarily does by snapping backward as he falls to his left? Yes. First of all, the snapback did not begin with the top of his head breaking apart. The explosive exit of brain tissue, blood, scalp, and other materials begins at Zapruder film frame 313. It's not until a couple of frames later that the backward movement begins. And to me, the movement is led by the torso, not the head. Plus, the head slightly nods forward with the shot. Then the back and head move backward while falling to the left and bouncing off the rear of the back seat. The House Select Committee on Assassinations convened a medical panel that offers a clear explanation of this. Former Dallas County Medical Examiner Dr. Charles Petty served on this panel. He testified in a mock trial of Lee Harvey Oswald that was held in the 1980s where he offered the explanation. I will quote him. He said, "The head snap to the rear, in the view of the panel, was an automatic involuntary reaction on the part of the president's nerves and muscles. There was a blast inside the head. The nerves were fired off, and the muscles were set into action. The muscles in the back are stronger than the muscles in the front, so therefore the head moved backward." End quote. A follow-up question posed to Dr. Petty inquired if a bullet could force a body movement. He answered, quote, "The head is too heavy. There is too much muscular resistance to movement." End quote. Both the initial investigation and the medical panel convened by the House Committee about 15 years later concluded that the bullet that went into President Kennedy's head broke into fragments and blasted out of the right temporal area of the head. So we have several fragments here. This can account for something hitting the windshield of the limousine, and I believe the wound to Governor Connally's wrist. Had Governor Connally not held his hat in such an obvious fashion following when he had clearly been shot in the back, I would have eventually believed the single bullet theory entirely, but I can't believe the conclusion offered by both investigations. Governor Connally is falling backward at the time of the Kennedy headshot. If you draw a line from the entrance and exit from Kennedy's head, it goes directly toward Connally's exposed right wrist. And as soon as the shot hits its mark, Connally immediately begins to flip over on his side and stomach, and eventually his arm falls. These conclusions I have made after years of thinking about it allow for every wound to President Kennedy and Governor Connally, the shrapnel hit to James Tague's face, damage to the vehicle, and Governor Connally's statements after the shooting and his actions inside the car. Three shots, all fired from the rear. But not in 5.5 seconds, as a possibility offered by the Warren Commission report. Depending on what version of the Zapruder film is played, the time frame is slightly different. Plus, several frames of the film are missing. Two frames in the immediate aftermath of where I believe the first shot was fired, and several while President Kennedy and Governor Connally were obscured by the road sign. My best estimate is that the shooting took anywhere from 9 to 9.5 seconds. This gives enough time to fire a Mannlicher Carcano rifle, the rifle Oswald owned, three times. Fire it. Cycle the bolt. Fire it. Cycle the bolt. Fire it. Now let's talk about the life-saving efforts at Parkland Hospital and the autopsy that night at Bethesda Naval Hospital. The Parkland Hospital doctors didn't do any analysis like an autopsy. They were trying to save the life of the patient. Once President Kennedy was pronounced dead, the Secret Service removed the body to Air Force One in a casket obtained in Dallas. Many, if not most, of the doctors who saw the president after he was wounded described a hole or missing portion of the head that stretched into the rear of the head. Some of the doctors were looking at him for quite some time. Does this mean, though, that a shot came from the front of the car? No, not in my opinion, and there's a simple explanation for this. The president is seated in the car and slumping to his left at the time of the headshot. Mrs. Kennedy climbs onto the trunk of the limousine in the immediate aftermath of the devastating shot to retrieve a portion of scalp that fell off the president's head. Once she climbs back in, she cradles JFK's body. Secret Service agent Clint Hill said he saw that the president's eyes were fixed. That tells me that almost immediately after he was shot, he was laying either on his side or somewhat face up in the car. A few minutes later, he is pulled from the car, put on a stretcher, and wheeled into Trauma Room 1 of Parkland Hospital. He was on his back at this point. So looking down on him, still bleeding with material such as brain matter falling out of the back of the head, it might seem in that moment he was hit from the front as everything was falling out of the back onto the table. The autopsy that night determined the measurements of the head wound. A small wound of entrance above and to the right of the part of the skull that sticks out of the back of the head, and a much larger wound stretching into the front of the head. Various pieces of scalp from the shooting scene in Dealey Plaza and in Parkland Hospital made up about 75% of the missing portion of the president's head. The report indicates the wound in the back was a quarter of an inch by about a half inch, and the larger wound was about 5 inches in its largest diameter. This indicates from the autopsy of a shot from the rear. Small wound of entry, large exit wound. While the doctors at Bethesda Naval Hospital conducting the autopsy did consult with Parkland Hospital about the wound in the president's neck, they concluded the shot that hit the president's back exited his neck, even though that wound was obliterated by the tracheotomy performed at Parkland. Now, those who argue conspiracy must attack the professionals who determined this was gunfire entirely from behind the car. So they want you to believe the men who performed the autopsy were not qualified. To me, it's the same as a defense attorney in a trial attacking a star witness for the prosecution by tearing said witness to shreds on the witness stand. It's really the only option. This was the President of the United States who was just assassinated, being examined at a military hospital. I personally do not believe for a second these men who did their duty that night under extraordinary circumstances were not qualified. Now, I do not think the autopsy was perfect. It seems to me the doctors originally missed the bullet wound in the throat, and that is a bit alarming, but they did clear it up after consultation with the doctors at Parkland Hospital. Now let's talk about Lee Harvey Oswald's known actions on November 22, 1963. He left his wedding ring and some money behind when he left for work and shows up to Buell Fraser's car with a lengthy package. No one can argue with that. Fraser, while convinced Oswald carried the package in a manner that some say would be impossible if it was a broken-down rifle, saw Oswald carry it into the book depository. Fraser never sees him again that day. However, another of Oswald's co-workers did see him on the sixth floor about 45 minutes before the shooting. That would make it around 11:45 a.m. According to the initial investigation, Charles Gibbons is the last person to see Oswald, clipboard in hand, before the motorcade arrived. That clipboard, by the way, investigators say had nothing on it to indicate Oswald used it for any official purpose. The shooting takes place at 12:30 p.m. Oswald is seen shortly afterward on the second floor by a police officer who lets him go because one of the building managers told the officer Oswald was an employee. An argument is made that Oswald seemed too calm for a man who just shot the president and within seconds ran into a police officer. But with the quick timing of the officer, the building manager, and Oswald just standing there, did Oswald really have time to make any real reaction at all? By the way, Oswald did not have a soft drink in his hand at the time. The initial report was that he wasn't even standing near the soft drink machine, and that the responding police officer simply saw Oswald through a glass panel, and that's the only reason why he was stopped. They did a timed reconstruction involving said officer and said building manager and someone making it from the window in the book depository to the second floor landing by the lunchroom, stopping long enough to stash the rifle near the stairway. It was entirely possible. Meanwhile, an eyewitness to the assassination sitting across the street from the Texas School Book Depository noticed a man in the sixth floor window a few minutes before the shooting. When the shots were fired, the man, Howard Brennan, looked back up at the window and saw the same individual, who was aiming for the final shot. Brennan described the man to police, and a description was radioed to Dallas police officers at around 12:45, 15 minutes after the shooting. White, slender, weighing about 165 pounds, about 5'10", in his early 30s. Now Oswald was 24 years old. He stood at 5'9". The weight at his autopsy, about 150 pounds. Oswald leaves the book depository. Investigators believe he took a bus, then a cab, to his rooming house. Now, how he got from point A to point B has never really interested me. He could have taken a tricycle, for all I care, but he did leave the depository around 12:33, and his housekeeper saw him enter his rooming house right around 1 p.m. Remember what former Sixth Floor Museum curator Gary Mack said in episode 3 of this podcast? Oswald gave the cab driver the wrong address. The driver, identified as William Whaley, originally said he dropped Oswald off around the 500 block of North Beckley. He later said it was closer to the 700 block of North Beckley. The 500 to 700 blocks of North Beckley would be a good 5 to 7 minute walk back to Oswald's rooming house at 1026 North Beckley. But in Whaley's original description of events, as quoted in the government's initial investigation, he claimed that while Oswald told him the 500 block of North Beckley, about 5 to 7 minutes by foot south of his rooming house, Oswald went ahead and said, "This is fine," when they were a short walk to the rooming house. This is where the cab driver gets confused depending on which time he is interviewed. Initially, he claimed he dropped Oswald off at Beckley and Neches. Now, those streets do not intersect but are right next to the rooming house. The 700 block of Beckley, though, is the corner of Beckley and Neely, a good 5 to 7 minute walk away. So which one is it? Beckley and Neely or Beckley and Neches? 5 minutes on foot too far or right next door? From this, we could take into consideration Oswald acting suspiciously if he indeed gave the cab driver the wrong address and was let out at the wrong address, or gave the cab driver the wrong address initially, then changed his mind once the cab got to his rooming house, and that's where he got out. Was it to see if the cops were there? Was it because he wanted to stop somewhere else on the way to his rooming house? We won't ever know that. But all indications are, regardless of where he was dropped off, Oswald gave the driver the wrong address, 500 North Beckley. He lived at 1026. He enters the rooming house around 1 p.m. According to the housekeeper, he's there for 3 or 4 minutes, appears to have gotten his jacket, and leaves on foot. Now let's talk about the shooting of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit. There isn't any argument of the time of the shooting in Dealey Plaza. There was a billboard on top of the Texas School Book Depository for Hertz rental cars, and attached to it was a giant clock. The clock read 12:30. One of President Kennedy's aides noted right before the shots were fired that it was 12:30 and that they were almost to the trademark. And police communications at the time said it was 12:30. Now, the Warren Commission establishes that Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit is killed at approximately 1:16. Another opinion is it had to have been slightly before 1:16 because of one of the witnesses in the area needing to be at a nearby bus stop. This is roughly 44 to 46 minutes after the shooting in Dealey Plaza. Lee Harvey Oswald would have had to get from point A to point B in that time to make this work. Could he have done this? I go with probably. Let's go back over of some of what I just went through quickly. Oswald left the Texas School Book Depository anywhere from 2 to 3 minutes after the assassination. He is stopped by the first responding police officer to enter the building after the officer heard the shots. The officer is with one of the managers of the building who clearly recognized Oswald. The manager told the officer Oswald worked there, so they left him alone. Oswald walked east on Elm a few blocks and got on a bus. Stuck in traffic because it's headed back toward where he came from, he got off, and walked a few blocks away to get a cab. The cab drops him off at some point, either next to or a few blocks away from his rooming house. That timing is about 27 minutes. Leaving the book depository at 12:33 and arriving at the 1026 North Beckley house at 1 p.m. You can actually do that in less than 10 minutes by car. So, walking to a bus, being stuck in traffic, walking to a cab, the cab ride, and possibly walking a few more blocks? Well, the timing works. And again, he's in and out of the rooming house at about 3 to 4 minutes, now wearing a jacket and carrying a revolver that was recovered on him at the time of the arrest. Now let's go over this question. Can you get from 1026 North Beckley to the area of 10th and Patton in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas in about 14 minutes by foot? That's the tough one. Different people have tried this. Hell, I've tried this. You gotta be going at a pretty good speed. And maybe Oswald was. Also, the housekeeper could have been off a little bit, and he actually entered the rooming house before 1 p.m. Maybe the timing of Tippett's shooting is a little off, too. But in some aspects, if you think about it, the timing might be 100% perfect. If that's how long it took, then that's how long it took. What we don't know and might be difficult to understand is why Oswald ended up near 10th and Patton in Oak Cliff, where Officer J.D. Tippit stopped him. Was he panicking and running all over creation? If his original plan was to hide in the Texas Theater, where he was later found and arrested, he wasn't headed in that exact direction after he left his rooming house. He was headed south, but then turned southeast, away from the theater. The theater is southwest. FBI agent Jim Hosty, who loves to focus on the Mexico City trip a few weeks prior to the assassination, acknowledges something in a book he wrote in the 1990s. He attributes this to a CIA investigation, and it blows my mind. When Oswald left the rooming house, the path he was headed on would have taken him to a bus stop, and a bus could have then taken him possibly to a local airport. Red Bird Airport, to be exact, again, in this Oak Cliff section of Dallas. Hosty writes the CIA investigation found a plane with no flight plan taking off from Redbird shortly after the announcement of Oswald's arrest. A plane matching the description landed in Mexico City. The time frame made it possible it was the same plane. Then the investigation claimed a man ran from the plane in Mexico City to another plane that was bound for Cuba. That Cuban-bound plane had delayed its flight plan for several hours. According to FBI agent Hosty, President Johnson eventually ordered the CIA to stop investigating anything related to Mexico City. Maybe Oswald was headed to the bus stop to go to Redbird Airport for an awaiting plane? Maybe Oswald was headed to the bus stop for another reason? Maybe he was in the area for a reason that has yet to be discussed. What we do know is we will never know. 12 people were eyewitnesses to the shooting of Officer Tippit. 5 identified Oswald that day. Another identified him the following day. 3 identified him through photos later on. 2 say Oswald resembled what they remember, and 1 said he was too far away. So of the 11 who made an identification according to the initial investigation, all say Oswald was the shooter or at least looked like the shooter. Let's talk about Oswald's actions after Tippit is gunned down. He's panicking, hiding, drops his jacket in the street, turns away from the direction he was originally headed, and goes west on Jefferson Boulevard. He's lurking into store windows and ducks into the Texas Theater where he does not buy a ticket. By this point, someone called the police because of Oswald's odd actions. Police respond, find him, arrest him. This is not some crazy police intuition because of the number of officers who responded like they want you to believe in the conspiracy movies. This is obvious. An officer is shot. Police were called about a guy hiding and acting strangely in the area. Of course, all available officers in the area would respond. Bottom line, even though they did not know this at the time, the only missing employee from the Texas School Book Depository who was unaccounted for was hiding in a theater only a few miles away. That's it, folks. That's the whole case as I see it. Lee Harvey Oswald killed President John F. Kennedy and Dallas Police Officer J.D. Tippit. But what has been hanging in my brain for years, and I wish I had read Hosty's book before I spoke with him. FBI agent Hosty's claims about a CIA investigation into a plane at Redbird Airport that could have been the same plane that landed in Mexico City, and then someone ran from that plane to another bound for Cuba, and Oswald could have been in the area of 10th and Patton to get on a bus to take him to the airport in Dallas where the plane originated? Added with Hosty's comments about a benign cover-up to prevent a conflict where the government told the truth, it just didn't tell the whole truth. That in context with Oswald's Mexico City trip prior to the assassination. Well, that would be huge. Let's quickly revisit a portion of my conversation with Agent Hosty. This is from Episode 3 of this podcast.
We have Castro telling one of our undercover people that Oswald came into their embassy and offered to kill Kennedy. You know, Castro got upset with the CIA trying to get him. And he came out and made a statement to the press that two people can play this game, or words to that effect. Also, the fact that Oswald then went out and met with a KGB agent who was, that was his department, assassinations. I guess that's known too. People didn't, a lot of people didn't, just didn't want to believe that. And the government didn't want to want that, didn't want to pursue that, that field. They, it, maybe it's true, maybe it isn't true. But they made no attempt to follow up on it.
So you're under the impression that Oswald did do it, in a sense, voluntarily doing it to help Fidel Castro.
Right. We don't we don't know if Oswald was told to do it, or if he just volunteered to do it, and they said, "Oh, get out of here, you're crazy nut."
Now, I don't know if I believe Oswald hopping a plane out of Dallas to be a credible possibility, but this is a retired FBI agent putting it out there. The plane at Redbird Airport and the proximity of the bus stop to the scene and timing of the Tippit shooting. Hostie and I did not discuss this. I read it in his book, Assignment Oswald, shortly thereafter. But making the claim about the plane and then explaining how President Lyndon Johnson stopped anyone from digging into anything involving Mexico City. That gives significant context looking back at President Johnson. In 1975, CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite released a portion of an interview he did with President Johnson upon Johnson leaving office in 1969, that Johnson later asked to be removed from the broadcast, Johnson admitting his true suspicions.
I can't honestly say that I've ever been completely relieved of the fact that there might have been international connections.
You mean you still feel that there might have been?
Well, I have not completely discounted.
Well, that would seem to indicate that you don't have full confidence in the Warren Commission report.
No, I think the Warren Commission's study, and I think, first of all, is composed of the ablest, most judicious, bipartisan men in this country. Second, I think they had only one objective, and that was the truth. The third, I think they were competent and did the best they could. But I don't think that they or me or anyone else is always absolutely sure of every thing that might have motivated Oswald or others that could have been involved.
This is really the only matter on the assassination where I'd love to see some official inquiry, even today. Even a statement from the FBI or CIA if such an inquiry would be possible or appropriate. Is it possible there could have been a plane waiting for Lee Harvey Oswald, and Officer Tippit got in the way? If true, that would be monumental. Or does it mean absolutely nothing? Even people like myself, who finally came around to the fact that Oswald did this, still have a lot of questions. Over the years, since high school, I've found myself as a fly on the wall in so many different circumstances. Whether it's being part of a conference or lecture, or being asked to speak on the subject myself, or listening to various people and even organizations defend their actions or opinions. Something has stood out to me that I find very unfortunate. There are so many talented, educated, even brilliant people in the research and historic areas of this subject, with all different kinds of beliefs, that are so petty and even hateful toward individuals on the quote-unquote other side, whatever other side that might be. I've heard notable conspiracy writers say that when someone changed their mind, it was because they sold out. Well, sold out to what? Did they get stock options and $5,000 suits in this change of mind? I was an eyewitness to one person bold enough to celebrate the death of a notable person on the other side when that person was speaking to random tourists in Dealey Plaza. And I've seen emails from a noted institution literally trying to get the police involved to get rid of those with different opinions in Dealey Plaza. It's ridiculous. It's disgusting. When students read about the assassination in a history book, they will only get a snapshot of one of the most trying weekends in the history of the United States. Obviously, the Kennedy assassination has to compete with other notable events to get enough pages to do the subject justice. But that's why we have writers, lecturers, and journalists like myself who can't leave the subject matter alone. And now that my opinion is public, I hope to still be used as a resource if anyone needs anything. And I want to stress that word, opinion. I'm not stating Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy and you should believe that too. It's what I believe now. I used to not believe it. And while that opinion could change again, I highly doubt it. I'm Eric Bushman. This is the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas. Feel free to reach out to me on Twitter at Eric J. Bushman.